Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the third sessional meeting of the Faculty of Actuaries for 2006/07. A special welcome to any guests that are present here this evening. In accordance with the newly established convention, I'm not planning to have the minutes read out this evening. They have been, of the minutes of the last meeting, they have been posted on the website. We have had no suggestion that they are in any way incorrect. Therefore, they are taken as a true record, and I have just now signed them. Instead, what we now do is that the President gives you a short update on what has happened since the last sessional meeting. And there are two things that I want to mention in passing. The one foreign trip that I've had on your behalf since the last sessional meeting was to Cologne in Germany just before Christmas. When the president of the Institute, Nick Dumbreck, and I met the leaders of the German DAV, the German Actuarial Association. This was actually quite a difficult meeting to physically because it occurred at the time of the Heathrow fog. After spending 6 hours at Edinburgh Airport, I eventually flew via Amsterdam and got there late at night. And Nick, after spending an equivalent time at Heathrow Airport, got the last train to Brussels and then got the train the next morning from Brussels to Cologne, which meant that I had to hold the fort the next morning between 9 a.m. and 9:45 when Nick arrived. I presented the German Actuarial Association with the CD of the Faculty of Actuaries dance, and the sheet music as well. And if Nick had been another 10 minutes, I was going to have to actually do it. But we managed to avoid that, which was, I'm sure, a great relief to the Germans as much as it was to me. But we did, seriously though, we did have a good meeting. Nick and I had a good meeting with the German Actuarial Association, and hopefully have helped as a result of that meeting to smooth out one or two issues which had been developing with the group consultatif. The other thing that I want to mention that has happened since the last sessional meeting is that those of you who were there may remember that I did launch, as part of my presidential address, a survey of opinion amongst members of the faculty. I am delighted to say that we had in total 550 responses to that, which I think is a magnificent response rate. Your President's Committee, which is the senior body of office bearers in the faculty, meets on the 25th of January to consider the outcome of that survey of opinion. I expect to have something. I did promise in my presidential address that I would keep the members informed as soon as there was anything of substance to say, and I'm very mindful of that, and I do plan to come back to you as soon as possible after the President's Committee meets at the end of this month to say something. No, I'm not sure yet what, but I'll say something. The other thing that I'd like to draw to your attention is something which is going to happen on the 5th of February. In recent years, we have developed a special diploma ceremony for new fellows. And the next ceremony happens on the 5th of February in the Merchants Company Hall in Edinburgh. It's starting at 5:45. It is a very nice event. It's new fellows and their families coming to receive the diplomas, and they hear a bit of a pep talk from me, which is maybe not what they were really coming for, but there is also a reception afterwards, and it has turned into something that's really a very nice event. I think any fellow who happens to be around in Edinburgh that evening would be most welcome if you want to come along and share that event with the new fellows and their families. Right, I think that's all I really want to say about other events. In coming back to tonight's event, an MP3 file of the meeting will be posted on the website in due course. May I remind you that there is a register which you should sign if you wish to record your attendance for CPD purposes. If you haven't signed it before the meeting, then please sign it before you leave this evening. The subject of the meeting is a presentation by the Credit Derivatives Working Party, and this will be followed by discussion and questions from the floor. I'd like to introduce the members of the panel. I think we're short of one. I think Gary Finkelstein hasn't been able to join us this evening, but we do have Paul Fulcher. And it's Paul who will be giving the the presentation shortly. Paul works for UBS Investment Bank, advising life companies and pension funds on the use of derivatives and credit derivatives. He previously worked for Friends Provident before joining UBS. Then Paul Coleman, another member of the working party, which has produced the paper. He's a director of Barclays Capital since 1996, and prior to that, he worked as a derivatives actuary at HSBC. I'll not say any more because those of you who are staying for Scottish Actuaries Club afterwards will doubtless get the full lowdown. Then moving to my extreme left here, another member of the working party is Paul Sweeting. Paul is currently a director in the Portfolio Strategies Group at Fidelity Investments a member of the firm board and an author of several SIAS and institutional sessional papers, one of which is being presented in Liverpool in April for those of you who may be around then. And on my immediate left, and I think I'm right in saying not a member of the Working Party, but someone who has joined us for the discussion this evening, Ewan Munro from Kirkcaldy, who is the head of multi-asset investing at Standard Life Investments. And before that, he was head of group funds, and before that, he was a bond fund manager at Standard Life Investments, and ultimately before that, at Prolific. I think that's all I really want to say in introduction of the panelists. So I think I now invite Paul Fulcher to give us a presentation on the subject matter this evening of credit derivatives. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, firstly, just to expand a little bit, the Derivatives Working Party is a permanent working party of the Life Research Board. Broadly speaking, looking at examples of the ways that life insurance companies use derivatives and how that use might be constrained or encouraged going forward. Historically, we've written a paper on equity derivatives that was presented to the Staple-in Actuarial Society, and last year we wrote this paper on credit derivatives, which we're presenting to you tonight. The purpose of the presentation I'm going to give is really to give people an overview of what was in the paper, recognising that not everyone may well have read it, and perhaps propose a few topics for discussion tonight. Why did we look at credit derivatives? Well, of all the areas in the derivatives market, credit derivatives are probably the fastest growing and where there's the greatest level of innovation at the moment. And probably the best way I can illustrate that is to give some figures on the size of the market. And actually, these are updated from the figures that are in the paper. And actually, we understated in the paper the growth that was expected in the market. So, for example, the current figure estimated is at the end of 2006, the total credit derivatives market was $20 trillion. That compares to just $5 trillion in 2004, and probably what was expected to be about $10 trillion when we wrote the paper at the end of 2006. It's always a little dangerous comparing statistics from different sources, so I'll treat this figure with a little bit of a pinch of salt, but figures we've seen for the size of the total debt securities market, the physical bond market, tend to be much lower. We quote a figure of $1.5 trillion in the paper. I saw the FT today was quoting something a bit higher than that, $6 or $7 trillion, but it's clearly smaller than the derivatives market. So in other words, that the credit derivatives market is now a bigger market than the underlying instruments on which that market is actually based. Now, if that seems a little illogical, it's perhaps worth explaining that the statistic we quote is the gross market size. So every time someone does a trade, that adds to the size of the market. And typically speaking, when a bank, for example, takes on credit risk, it might, for example, issue a CDO to investors, and I'll explain what they did later on, which will give it certain credit protection. It may well then hedge that with another instrument in the market with another investor, meaning its net position is basically zero. No real credit risk has been created or destroyed, but actually that would add to the statistics on the volume of the market. So that's why the underlyings can actually be smaller than the overall derivative market. Just to get another figure to put it in context, the total OTC derivatives market, and actually the FT quoted this figure again today, is estimated at $370 trillion. So though credit derivatives are quite an area of interest, they're actually not the biggest area of the derivatives market. That really falls to the interest rate derivatives. What are the key instruments? Well, I'll explain some of this terminology a little later, but single name credit default swaps are the basic building block. Again, when we wrote the paper, I think we said they're about 50% of the market. The latest figures, that's actually fallen quite significantly, and they're almost now not the dominant instrument anymore. The big growth now, and again, another change since we wrote the paper, is in index products. And historically, that's always been a big difference between the credit derivative market and the equity derivative market. When we think of equity derivatives, we think of options on the FTSE and other equity indices. Historically, credit's all about being options on particular names or particular baskets of names. Again, there's been a big change recently to introduce index product into the credit derivative market. And the other key product or building block is really the credit, collateralized debt obligation, the CDO. And again, I'll explain what that is in a few slides. What do we expect to see in terms of development of the market? Well, the key themes tend to be a lot of innovation. You could say the market runs ahead of itself a little bit in terms of coming up with the latest new product. But at the same time as innovation, there's quite a lot of standardization. And that, I think, is quite helpful for life companies and pension funds and other end users who are perhaps less sophisticated in this area, is the growth of things like index products and the standardization of market terms. And perhaps increasingly exchange-traded credit derivatives, which haven't historically been a big feature. So looking at the basic building block that I mentioned, the credit default swap, you know, as I said, this constitutes about half of all credit derivatives and typically is the building block for most of the other products as well. What is a credit default swap? Well, in one way, it's a form of insurance. You have a protection buyer and a protection seller. A protection buyer wants to obtain protection on some credit exposure that they may well have, and they pay a premium each year, 50 basis points on the amount of credit that's protected, something like that, to the protection seller. As with all insurance contracts, if nothing happens, nothing happens, and at the end of the period, say 5 years, the contract simply ends. But if during those 5 years, that's what's called a credit event, and we go into that in detail in the paper, but you can really think of that as a default of the underlying name or bankruptcy of the underlying corporate, then a sort of settlement takes place. Effectively, that's where the insurance kicks in. In that case, that's the graph at the bottom, the protection buyer effectively gives its bonds, or bonds of the value of the nominal amount that's being protected, to the protection seller. The protection seller, in return, gives the buyer the par value of the bonds. Now, why is that important? You say, well, basically you can think of it, you know, someone's bought a bond that promises to pay 100. What happens is that if the company goes into default, the protection seller instead gives them the 100. They give them in place the bonds, which are obviously worth less because of the default. So effectively it's almost like, a form of insurance. Their defaulted bond is replaced almost new for old by the amount that they expected to get when that bond matured. Now, I've used the knowledge of insurance there. It's quite important to say, for actually legal reasons as well as other things, credit default swaps are not, legally speaking, insurance. And one of the key differences between credit default swaps and insurance is that the protection buyer doesn't actually have to have an insurable interest. You can buy credit protection on a company for which you actually have no credit exposure. In fact, that's probably the most common way these things are done. That's an important thing to understand because it's very much a synthetic market. Ditto, people can sell credit protection on things that they have no ability to actually hedge out the other side. It's a way of transferring risk in the market. The other way of thinking of a credit default swap is that it's a synthetic way of buying bonds in a company. So if someone wants to buy a bond, they pay 100 to someone, they receive coupons, and at the end of the term, assuming the bond hasn't default, they get their money back. Another way of doing that is to take some cash, put it in the bank, and buy a credit default swap, effectively be the protection seller. So someone pays you the credit spread, and if nothing happens, that's fine. You've got your money back because you can withdraw your cash. If something has happened, you have to provide that cash as part of the cover under the contract. So synthetically, a credit default swap is a way of buying a bond in a company, but without actually having to physically pay over the amounts at the start and end of the contract. That leads on to quite an important concept, which we again explore in a bit of detail in the paper, which is the technical term basis. Because a bond and a credit default swap are essentially economically the same, in an arbitrage-free and perfect world, you might expect them to be priced the same. In reality, they're not, and there are various technical reasons why they're not, and that creates a whole industry of people who trade what's called the basis, in other words, exploit differences between the price of the physical bond and the price of the credit default swap. The second probably key credit derivative to understand is the CDO, sometimes called various other names, but we use the name CDO in the paper. Effectively, a CDO is a way of obtaining different types of exposure to some underlying credits. And probably an easy way to think of a CDO is to imagine that a company is set up, and that company effectively raises 100 of capital and uses that to buy 100 of bonds. Now, if that company just had equity holders, nothing would have really happened. The underlying people who own the shares in the company would effectively own the bonds. And so that would have would not have transformed the credit in any way. But actually, CDOs work on a different principle. They tend to finance themselves by issuing different amounts of capital. So for example, you have an equity piece, which takes most of the risk and gets most of the return. And then you have different levels of capital with different levels of seniority. And the key thing to understand is that the different levels of capital take on different levels of risk exposure, they achieve different levels of return, and they're exposed to very different levels of risk when defaults happen. And that's probably easier to explain by an example. So if we look at the slide here, a common terminology uses the mezzanine tranche. The mezzanine tranche of a CDO is a tranche that doesn't take the first part of risk, but it doesn't take the higher levels of risk either. So for example, an insurance company might take the exposure to losses on the portfolio between 4% and 8%. So you've got, say, 120 bonds, for sake of argument. If over, the five-year term of the CDO, less than 4% is lost on that portfolio by way of defaults, and that probably means about 8 of the 120 bonds defaulting, allowing for the fact that bonds, when they default, usually pay something back, typically sort of 40% or something. So if 7 or 8 bonds default or less, the mezzanine holder is completely protected. Basically, the equity tranche at the bottom absorbs all of that risk. So even though there's been some losses on the underlying portfolio, the mezzanine investment holder actually gets all his money back plus his credit spread. So in that sense, he's effectively bought some protection. So that's the sort of the good side, if you like, from the risk exposure. But equally, he then takes a very leveraged, a very geared exposure to the next lot of losses. So in this example, the next 4% of losses eat on a much higher, sort of almost like a 25-to-1 basis into his capital. So for example, if there are 6% losses on the underlying portfolio, because that's halfway through his tranche, 4 to 8%, actually at the end of the term, he doesn't get back 100, he only gets back 50. So he's simultaneously sort of he's got protection against a few losses, but then a very geared exposure to the next tranche of losses. And so that creates a very different payment profile in terms of the risk and return than you get from a physical bond portfolio. And it also introduces an exposure to correlation, which is another sort of technical term we talk about in the paper. If you were the holder of the equity tranche, you're exposed to the first losses on the portfolio, 4% in this case. What you really want to happen is for lots of losses to happen at once, because if you get lots of losses, it blows through your sort of area, your tranche completely, and really those losses are borne by the higher level, the mezzanine and higher tranches. So you actually benefit the higher correlation is. In contrast, if you're the super senior holder here, who's protected against the, who's only really exposed to incredibly severe losses, 10%, 20% losses on the underlying portfolio, the only real thing that will tend to cause you to lose money is an awful high level of correlation where all defaults happen at once. So again, a sort of a pricing subtlety when it comes to CDOs is that you introduce this new variable correlation, which is perhaps something that insurance companies and pension funds aren't that used to managing, and maybe one of the barriers to understanding, shall we say, in terms of these investments. Why does this whole sort of CDO thing exist? Why on earth are people interested in this sort of thing? Well, a number of reasons. Issuers, people like banks, have actually found it a cheap way of financing their mortgage books, for example. So again, if you look in the FT today, there's an article from Northern Rock, you know, one of our more, you might think, conservative building societies, historically, who actually finance their entire mortgage book in this way. So they actually write mortgages, but then they effectively issue them as CDOs into the market, which means that for every 100 of mortgages they write, they actually get back 95, something like that, in capital from other investors, leaving them only really with the equity tranche. So they take a much more geared and sort of more rewarding but also more risky exposure to their mortgage book, but they get a lot more capital in an efficient way. From an investor's point of view, as I said, it's a way of altering the risk return profile of credit and obtaining a different type of exposure. So why might life companies use credit derivatives? Well, I think it's probably fair to say historically they haven't been massive users. Equity derivatives and interest rate derivatives has been a much more sort of common thing for them to use. And I think perhaps in the discussion and with perhaps some end users represented on the other side, we might be able to explore the reasons that's been the case. But why might they use credit derivatives? Well, credit default swaps can be quite, you know, a way of taking exposure to credits. One big theme for both life companies and pension funds over the last few years has been that when you buy a corporate bond, you're buying two things. You're buying an exposure to some particular issuer, British Telecom, or whoever it might be, and you're also buying some interest rate duration to match your liabilities. Well, at the moment, with the physical bond market, you're effectively getting two things at the same time, and it may well be optimal to separate those two things, to separate the way you take your credit risk from the way you match your liabilities. One way of doing that is using interest rate derivatives. Another way of doing that is using credit derivatives and using government bonds to do the matching. Yield enhancements become quite a theme. It's interestingly, and actually perhaps an area of crossover between life companies and pension funds. You know, the new buyout vehicles that have entered the market, private equity providers to provide bulk purchase annuity buyouts for insurance companies, a lot of them are looking at cranking up the yield they receive on their portfolios as one of the ways they hope to add value in the market. And things like CDOs as a way of getting higher yield for a particular level of credit rating and a way of providing diversified exposure to their other assets is something that they are looking at. And we're perhaps seeing that have an effect on some of the existing players who are rethinking the way that they do things. Another area potentially of application is hedging. The heaviest users of credit derivatives historically have very much been banks because their whole business is taking credit risk and finding ways of tranching that risk up and passing it on and taking the parts they do and don't want has been a key thing for them. Insurance companies are also not so exposed to credit risk, but largely they tend to have quite large credit exposures. Particularly in annuity books, they've often backed a lot of their liabilities almost entirely with credit. And ways of providing some sort of protection against credit have become a theme over the last year or two, particularly for those in the life sector, as credit stress tests have come into play, which historically we haven't had. A way of doing that, if I speak back a couple of slides, much the same way as a bank, is to, for example, use a CDO type of technology to obtain some sort of protection. For example, if you sell mezzanine bonds into the market based on your credit portfolio, that effectively means that you get a certain amount of protection. If you flip that graph on its head, you'll see that you then obtain protection as the life company against credit losses between, say, 4% and 8% on your portfolio. So again, hedging has perhaps been a more talked about, I think, than done theme. Again, something we may want to explore in the discussion, but it has gone up people's agendas. Why haven't life companies used credit derivatives historically? Well, I think firstly, I said, let's be clear, it's a market that's been really driven by the banking industry historically. It's credit risk for them is the be-all and end-all risk. For life companies, it's perhaps historically not been their biggest risk, although as people reduce equity backing ratios, I think it's becoming a bigger risk for them to consider and something that needs to be managed more efficiently. The market itself, compared to some markets, isn't as well developed. And so things like liquidity and pricing transparency are still concerns. And again, life companies is relatively cautious and institutional investors with a certain fiduciary responsibility to their underlying policyholders, that's perhaps a bigger issue for them than it has been, for example, for hedge funds who have been a lot more active in this market. When people try and do hedging, basis risk has been an issue. Can I actually obtain, there are these index products, but do those indices bear much resemblance to my particular credit portfolios? And that's often not been the case because the indices are really driven by the euro and the US dollar markets, less so by sterling bonds. And then there have been some regulatory barriers. When we wrote the paper, and this is definitely a correction to the paper, the FSA representatives on our working party rather helpfully pointed out a loophole in the regulatory rules, which was unusual for them, that meant that buying credit derivatives from an insurance company was actually relatively straightforward if they were taking risk. Effectively, the loophole in the rules was that if you could call something a bond, it was admissible as a bond, and the fact that it might be a very leveraged derivative instrument didn't matter because you could just say, well, it's a bond, don't need to look any further. I said they very helpfully pointed that out in the paper and then went back to their base in Canary Wharf and drafted up a rule to close that loophole. So those of you who have followed any of the recent quarterly consultation papers, that's definitely a correction to our paper. The quasi-derivative rule, as it was called, that they had managed to miss out has very firmly been put back, so that door has somewhat been slammed. So there are often regulatory barriers that mean that even though you might be doing something that makes good economic sense, it may fail certain admissibility rules. And then to touch briefly on one theme that's perhaps related to credit derivatives, but not purely derivatives, that we touch on in the paper, and that's the so-called credit spread puzzle. If you look at the spread, even in today's conditions when credit spreads are very, very tight by historic standards, if you look at the spread that you earn on a credit bond or a credit derivative, and you compare that to the expected level of defaults, if you look at Moody's or S&P's data for the last 30 years, based on how likely it is that a AA bond might default over the next 5 years, and you compare the two, you'll find that on average, there's a seeming sort of gain there. The credit spread you get paid is quite a bit higher than the expected losses that you will incur. And that's something that's been called the credit spread puzzle and has been debated huge length, it has to be said, in the academic world. And no one's really come up with a completely satisfactory explanation so far. And in the paper, we do a survey of the literature, really, to touch on some of the... We don't so much reach a conclusion as at least give some of the different answers. What are the answers that people have given? Well, to be honest, the most obvious one is it's a risk premium. Actually, the anomaly would be if that didn't exist, that gap. Because if you expected to earn the same on a risky instrument as on a non-risky instrument, why would you buy the risky instrument? If you add to that the fact that credit has a particularly skewed type of payoff, 19 times out of 20 you get your money back, or even 99 times out of 100, but the one in 100 when you lose a lot. You typically get back 20, 30, 40 pence in the pound on those occasions. Then again, it's a risk that typically the financial markets expect to be compensated for. We were discussing actually earlier, some of us, the earthquake bonds, things like that, are another example where very sort of infrequent but very severe occurrences when they happen are something that the market demands a very high risk premium for. So again, it's not surprising, really. It's arguably not an anomaly at all in that regard. Other reasons people have given are tax effects, although that's more of a US issue, and small sample bias. I mean, it's arguable that when we look at this historic data from 1970 to 2004, have we really had the sort of 1929 financial meltdown that really perhaps explains why people expect to get paid a premium to take credit risk. But there still seems to be this sort of gap in the middle, a sort of an unexplained part of risk that attaches itself to credit, which people tend to refer to as liquidity risk. And people try and quantify that, and sometimes they say it's almost nothing, sometimes they say it's up to 50 basis points. Why does that matter? Well, life companies in particular have tended to capitalize that liquidity premium. You know, in the old regulatory peak world, credit is a little bit of a free lunch. You back your annuity business with credit, you can actually hold lower reserves than if you back it with risk-free bonds. Isn't true if you hold equities or something like that. So not surprisingly, most annuity books are backed with 100% credit. Even in the sort of the new risk-neutral world that we're sort of moving to with Pillar 1, Peak 2, and ICA, again, we find that even in that world, parts of the legislation actually enshrine that liquidity premium. For annuity business, you are allowed to use higher than risk-free rates to discount your liabilities. So again, from a regulatory point of view, life companies effectively place a certain amount of reliance on this, and it's labelled them to hold lower reserves. And in a way, if life companies are saying, well, credit is a bit of a free lunch for us as long-term holders of credit, then that makes credit derivatives and ways of cranking up that risk potentially more attractive. So one of the reasons that some life companies have bought CDOs is taking the view that, well, I can actually get even higher. I can effectively take that liquidity premium and leverage it up and get higher returns for a higher level of risk, but a bit of a capital benefit. There's a variety of approaches people have used, even in market-consistent world, as I said. So just to sum up, really from our point of view, some discussion points that people might be interested in, although we're obviously very, very happy to take questions on any topic. When is it appropriate for insurers and pension funds to use credit derivatives and also to use CDOs? And what might be the risks associated with that? Do they fully understand what they're taking on? The FSA a few years ago instigated a project where they seemed very concerned. John Tyner, I think, kicked it off, that actually banks were using CDOs and CDSs to dump credit risk on unsuspecting investors, including life companies. They actually concluded that it wasn't the case, largely because they actually found the take-up of these instruments wasn't as high as they thought. But, you know, is there a risk that the life company are the mug in the game who's being transferred risk in a very structured form? Can CDOs be used as hedging instruments? Are they good ways of reducing risk? Or again, does that create certain issues? Are life companies and pension funds in the room that are represented here actually thinking about the use of these instruments? And again, we'd perhaps be interested in any views on the liquidity premium. Is there some magic premium associated with the use of credit that enables life companies to, as long-term holders of these instruments rather than short-term holders, to obtain a little bit of a free lunch when they invest in credit? It's quite possible there is. Markets aren't 100% efficient, but equally there are arguments that there aren't. So I think that's where I'd like to leave the discussion. I guess I'll hand back to Stuart at this point.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Just before I throw the meeting open for questions and comment, I think we now can welcome Gary Finkelstein. Good to see you, Gary. Thanks. Gary will correct me if I'm wrong, but he currently leads the risk management practice at Milliman and was formerly with Ernst & Young.
Thank you.
So welcome to you, Gary.
Thank you.
The meeting is now open for questions and comments. Can I please ask people to speak your names clearly and keep the microphone close to your mouth so that what you say can be properly recorded. And for those who are speaking with the benefit of notes, can I please ask you to pass a copy of your notes after the meeting to Mary, who's sitting at the back there in the check, black and white check top. So may I invite the first question or comment, please? Maybe on the questions on the screen or not, just as you feel. Paul.
Just in case anybody thinks this is cheating, I'm not actually a member of the working party, so this is a, so this is a genuine question. On the credit premium, I just wondered to what extent trading costs differ for different credit instruments, and how much they differ between credit instruments and government bonds, and the extent to which regular trading could erode that premium, or could actually explain that premium, that in fact you only really get it if you hold bonds for a reasonable period of time.
Shall I pick up on that, or do you want to?
I'll tell you. The trading costs generally are fairly light for credit default swaps on liquid names. So if the trading cost element of it was an explanation for why there's a spread, we should have expected to see some trend coming through on that with much more liquid names trading credit default swaps would see their spread collapse, and the names where there isn't much liquidity through credit default swaps presumably would offer a much better spread. And I don't think there's any real evidence in that. Trading costs tend to get borne at the time as an inefficiency for those organisations that trade a lot. There's no real payment for that by the market. And it's similar to not being paid for specific risk under other instruments. You're assumed to be able to act in a way that eliminates specific risks. You're supposed to be able to trade in a way that eliminates costs and is more efficient. And the entities that don't do that are the ones that end up with less spread. But you don't get paid specifically for that.
I can just have one comment. I think if there is a time horizon issue, and that's really what the life and pension industry is almost relying on, that there is that time horizon issue. Certainly when we looked at the literature, the one thing, the hole I found in the literature, and I didn't volunteer to fill it, but I at least noted it as a hole, is that a lot of the talk about the use of a risk premium and the fact that the credit spread compensates you for risk was really focused on sort of short-term mark-to-market risk. You know, and credit spreads, if you own a bond or any sort of credit instrument, your short-term risk is credit spread moves, that credit spreads blow in and out. And they can be quite volatile and have a certain amount of market noise associated with them. Your long-term risk is really, does that bond default or not? And as a held-to-maturity investor, you can arguably, particularly if the regulation allows you to, which it does for most life companies and pension funds, ignore that short-term volatility. And as long as the bond doesn't either get downgraded or default, you can effectively say that nothing's happened, you haven't had any loss. And I think there is a strong argument that life companies and pension funds potentially benefit from that, because you know that's if you may be being overcompensated for short-term risk that you maybe should care about, but at least in a regulatory view you don't care about. And therefore you're rewarded if you're a long-term holder of those instruments. And sort of long-term arbitrages in markets are the sort of things that can exist more easily, because a short-term arbitrage is easy for someone to hedge in and out of, but if something that's really can only be exploited by someone who's in it for the long term, 10 or 15 years, then that's very difficult for hedge funds and people to arbitrage away. So I think that's the rationale, at least, that life companies would probably subscribe to, that they're benefiting from being long-term holders probably more because they can ignore noise in the market. I said whether that's true or not is unfortunately not very well addressed by the literature. Well, it's not addressed at all, I think.
I personally think it's an interesting question. If you were looking, I think it depends on the type of credit derivative that you're looking at as well. It's certainly true that trading costs are not as high as you would think, but they are still higher than they are, say, for equity derivatives. For example, if you're looking at the trading cost on a futures contract on the iTraxx or a futures contract on the Lehman Ag Bond Index, it's 1 or 2 basis points higher than the futures contract on equity, an equity index. I'm not sure how much of that adds up to the puzzle, the answer to the puzzle. And it is true that, as it is in the case of equity derivatives, that trading costs in an OTC structured credit derivative are going to be higher than they are in a futures contract. So if you were trying to use credit derivatives to manage a portfolio of guarantees, say on a bond fund, if you're using structured assets, then if you needed to rebalance at some point, there's going to be a higher trading cost than there would have been if it was an equity fund. But
there is an interesting follow-on from that question as well, that as you say, that trading costs generally, if you were incorporating those, would be higher for longer term bonds because you've got longer periods in which you might want to trade it. And as Paul said, for the short term at least, the main risk is spread movement, and spread movement has bigger impact the longer the duration of the bond. So it's another interesting question as to why don't long-term bonds pay a materially higher credit spread than short-dated bonds do. We've seen a lot of activity in the market over the last few years with insurance companies moving their credit portfolio shorter, really, for partly for that reason, and also because the capital calculations now recognise this greater spread impact coming through the longer-term bonds, but there really isn't a higher premium associated with taking longer-term credit views at the moment, and perhaps there should be.
Can I just comment on what possibly one of the reasons is that the penalty for pension funds for holding very long-duration credit is quite slight under the new accounting rules, and that they are discounting their liabilities off AA credit. So unlike insurance companies, which tend to these days discount off some risk-free measure, albeit risk-free is often gilts plus 10 or something like that, the pension funds do have an advantage there, and so they're not disadvantaged in buying the very long-duration credit. Can I pick up, if I may, on another point, which is the difference between spread risk and default risk? Because one of the advantages of CDOs is that you can place a bet, if you like, I'm speaking as a fund manager, on a number of credits, and you say, of this 100 credits, I firmly believe that no more than 3 or 4 will default, and therefore I'm going to buy a mezzanine tranche. And that seems like a nice view, and you get a spread that's attractive as a result. One of the worries I would have in putting that in place for an insurance client is the volatility rating in the interim. While I'm waiting on these names not defaulting, there can be quite extreme moves in the volatility of that tranche that I'm holding. How do you propose that would be managed? These things have to be held for a period of time. How would you manage that volatility?
I agree that's a big issue for insurance companies, because at least for the ICA calculations, the FSA will expect a modelling of a CDO tranche on a look-through basis. So when you're doing credit spread tests and 1 in 200 year events, looking at the impact on the mark-to-market of those tranches. We've got the models, other people have got models, and you'll see that the gearing effect that Paul talked about in the presentation does come through quite clearly in the mark-to-market, expected mark-to-market of the tranches. I suspect that has proved an obstacle for insurance companies, and probably will do. Until the insurance companies are looking at that technology as a way of actively managing the credit risk, because if you're taking more credit risk, then clearly that can act against you if spreads widen and the asset value falls dramatically. But if you're using the technology as a hedge, as Paul suggested insurance companies may do, then clearly that can become very beneficial. Because the protection that those tranches give you against credit spread widening is very real. If spreads widen then and you've sold protection, then you benefit quite extensively. So I think using the technology to both take credit risk and buy back credit risk in other parts of the structure enables you to manage the spread widening risk and actually have it work in your favour, as well as taking absolute default risk on names that you're happy to take a view on. But I think just taking simple one-way bets, if you like, isn't going to work too well through the actuarial calculations, and therefore it's going to be fairly limited, the appetite insurance companies have for that in terms of the way they have to put capital up against it.
Any question or comment from the floor, please? Gentleman at the back there, thanks.
Hi, Sean Fair, Scottish Widows Investment Partnership. It struck me, just looking at the structure of the CDO that you put up on the screen, and not having done a lot of work with CDOs, you need to forgive me for my my naivety on this, but it looks remarkably like the structure of a split cap investment trust. And I was just thinking about the history of split cap investment trusts and wondering if there is, or if there already has been, a nesting of CDOs within CDOs, and to what extent we're able to actually evaluate the risks of such nesting in the way that we didn't evaluate the risks of split cap investment trusts.
I think it's probably true to say in the early days of CDOs there were some problems associated with them, and actually probably one thing I forgot to touch on actually when I did the presentation is that in the early days of CDOs, most CDOs were what we call cash CDOs, so someone would literally, every single tranche of that structure would have to be bought by someone. The physical bonds would be purchased. Usually there were bonds that actually already sat on a bank's balance sheet, and the bank would sort of choose the bonds and put them in the CDO, and then they'd sell off all the different tranches to different investors. And in those type of structures, there is a potential conflict of interest between the different investors, and a potential conflict of interest between the bank and the investors, because the bank's choosing the names that go in. And you go back to when I started in the market 5 years ago, investors wouldn't even be told what names were in those portfolios. They'd get sort of a guidance in terms of, there's 10% banks and 20% financials, and 5% AAA and X% BBB, and some of it's in UK and some of it's in Europe. But say when Parmalat went bust, you'd have to almost wait to find out if you happened to have Parmalat in your portfolio or not, and chances are that you probably did. I think the market's evolved a lot since then, particularly because I think it's perhaps the investor side that's now starting to drive it. And so, for example, typically now there's complete transparency on the names. A lot of issuance is what's now called synthetic, which actually means that the investor effectively, so take this example here with the 4%, 8% mezzanine tranche, an investor who wants a tranche like that, he or she chooses the names that go into that portfolio completely, chooses which tranche they take of interest on that. So they're the ones choosing the names that go in, they're the ones choosing which tranche they're taking. And actually the bank really just hedges out all the different tranches in the market using credit derivatives and manages it as part of its risk book. It isn't having to find an equity tranche holder and a super senior tranche holder with the potential scope for conflict between them. So I think, as with most markets, it's a market that's developing. And yes, there have been some problems in the past, and I think those are being addressed, but it's an ongoing issue. I think the other issue for investors, as I said, is do they understand what they're investing in? Do they understand the risk profile that they're getting? It's, it's mentioned on the slide here, for example, this mezzanine tranche here might well be single A or double A rated, but it will have a very different risk profile to a typical portfolio of A or double A bonds because of this very sort of different payoff profile where you get protection against certain names and then losses after that. And as Ewan said, you have to sort of know what you're doing. If you buy this tranche, you are taking the view that I think there's going to be less than a certain number of losses, but actually not much more than that. And that's, if that's the investment view you're taking, you can express it this way. If you buy it just because someone's shown you, here's a nice AA investment and it yields 100 over risk-free, please buy it and don't look any further, then that's where you're getting into dangerous territory, I think.
I think there's one comment on that. The CDO is essentially the same as an investment trust. Investment trusts are simple, generally two tranche level CDOs where you've got debt and equity. And clearly they've been successful over many years in that way, giving geared exposure to equities to the equity holders, and with the debt being equivalent to a super senior tranche of a CDO and hopefully going to pay out. The issue with split capital investment trusts really highlights two things, in my view anyway. One is, if you are buying different levels within a CDO structure, you do need to be very aware of the effect of correlation on your portfolio, as Paul said, because if you're buying the senior part, the debt part, or the zero dividend preference share within a split capital investment trust, and the names turn out to be highly correlated, so they move down together, then your investment will prove to be a lot more risky than maybe you want it to be. because the equity gets wiped out entirely. The other thing, which isn't a feature of CDOs generally, but which was a feature of split caps, is that the investments that were being held within the split caps were themselves leveraged. So you ended up with a gearing on gearing effect, which exacerbated the correlation and meant that some of those clearly ploughed into the ground. And I guess you may see, we've already seen some element of that within CDO technology with things called CDO squareds, where some of the underlying assets are themselves other CDOs. So you do have to be concerned about how that may impact on the leverage effect and how it may impact as you go down different tranches, particularly of concern if you're buying tranches which you may believe to be very secure, AAA super senior type tranches, to understand how those correlation and leverage effects could impact upon you if things start to go bad.
Just if I may, the comment about nesting of CDOs, and to some extent the problem about these things being in the past, certainly things have improved, and I think the fact that now the banks that are issuing the CDOs are normally independent from the managers that are choosing the collateral behind the CDO is an improvement. But these things are not all in the past. As recently as March 2006, in a nested a CDO of CDOs, the Zelo 3 series in 2005, one company, Dana, an automotive part manufacturer, defaulted, and the AAA tranche went to BB plus overnight. The thing was that all of the underlying CDOs must have had exposure to that name, Dana. And so you need to understand the collateral pool that's behind these things.
Okay, can we have the next question or comment from the floor, please? Well, perhaps while people are gathering their thoughts, I might pose something to the panel myself. We have here, we had a question up about when is it appropriate for insurers and pension schemes to use CDSs and why. My question is really about the differences between life offices and pension schemes. Are there situations, and I think Ewan has already mentioned one, where there may be a particular advantage for, you know, that the investment may be more attractive for a pension scheme than for a life office. And I'm wondering if there are any other examples like that, and I'm wondering how would the market cope if the reason why something was more attractive to one than the other, to a life office rather than a pension scheme or vice versa, if that reason suddenly changed. I'm thinking, for example, about the FRS 17 accounting standard for pension schemes, which is currently under review. And if it moved away from AA bond yields, what would be the effect on the credit derivative market? So that is a double-edged question. You know, are there any other examples of different attractions according to whether you're a life office or a pension fund, and how would the market react if there were a sudden change in the reason for such an attraction?
You know, my initial just gut feel answer to that is, I think the best way of using derivatives of any kind, credit or any other, is for economic reasons. And economically, there are a lot of similarities between defined benefit pension schemes, at least, and life insurance companies, namely guarantees on some underlying asset mix. And if that asset mix has got defaultable bonds within it, then there's an embedded option on credit. When derivatives start being used for accounting reasons or for regulatory reasons, almost regulatory arbitrage, finding a fix for a rule, the problem is what happens if the rules change. I haven't got an answer to your question. I'm not an expert on pension funds and on the changes to FRS 17, but I think it just raises a general point that what one needs kind of back out reversibility if it's being used for regulatory capital reasons or accounting reasons in the event that
those rules change.
Certainly the regulatory pressure on life companies, I think, does push them to the forefront of using CDS technology. Part of the reason for that is credit default swaps at the moment really are efficient and available in the 5 to 10 year space. So if you're trying to buy long-dated credit, then using credit default swaps as an alternative really doesn't stack up. And historically, insurance companies have tended to manage interest rate and the credit at the same time, and it's been just about practical to do that using bonds. So you end up in long-dated space. There's no reason to go short-dated because the rules weren't there to press a capital advantage of moving short-dated. So actually using credit default swaps could look more trouble than it was worth, because you didn't really want to operate in the 5 and 10 year credit space, and that's where the credit default swaps are available. So I think the pension funds are still there, really. If they want to take credit, they may as well take long dated and just operate in physical space. There's no pressure from a regulator to force them shorter. Once you're moving shorter, then the advantage of using credit default swaps comes in, because you're in that space anyway, and there's more names available and liquidity available. And then you get the second level of the regulatory side on life companies, which is the potential benefits that you can get from extra diversification. Which again, also doesn't apply to pension funds. So if a life company wants to start using its capital more efficiently in credit space at the moment, the logical thing to do is to move shorter and to buy a lot wider range of names. And that sort of pushes you to thinking quite seriously about credit default swaps, where you have good liquidity in a wider range of names. That doesn't exist for pension funds, so why would they bother? It's a lot of trouble to go and put systems in place to cope with something you've not done in the past, so they're not really keen to do that. In terms of how the market would react, I hate to guess. Illogically, usually, is a good bet, I think.
I think it's probably fair to say the impact on the credit derivatives market probably wouldn't be enormous, for the simple reason that life companies and pension funds aren't huge users at the moment. I mean, just looking at some statistics here from the BIS from June, suggesting that about market share of insurance companies in the credit derivatives market is 2 or 3%. But I think perhaps what we can see is what happened in the physical bond market before, when CP195 first came out, and suddenly it was proposed that life companies would have to hold capital against credit. The paper came out in about August, and for some reason nobody paid any attention to it. And then in about January, everybody suddenly got very excited, and it became a big story in the credit markets. And then the market did start moving. Spreads started changing a little bit, and the shape of the curve changed. And then when PSO, what was it, 0416 came out, I think it was on the 1st of July 2004, something like that. I remember actually sitting in the FSA when they launched it on a BlackBerry, BlackBerrying back to the office. And we actually had people trading bonds in real time, if you like, you know, as the guy was speaking, and the information was coming out on what the new proposals were. But they weren't actually life companies. What we actually saw was quite a lot of activity from hedge funds and other sort of more financial investors, including in one case, I certainly remember an asset manager with a life company arm, but it wasn't their life funds they were trading for. So there was quite a lot of activity of people trying to, shall we say, anticipate what the life companies would do because of the change in regulation, and literally doing trades that day, you know, to get it done by lunchtime based on what the new rules were and how supranational bonds were going to be treated differently to what people thought, etc. It's probably taken the life companies probably about 2 or 3 years since then. Probably they're still in the process of actually changing the way that they manage their credit portfolios to reflect the changing rules, because I think they're longer term investors. They tend to want to think things through. They're probably not going to sort of switch huge amounts of assets at the sort of drop of a hat just because a rule's changed. So funnily enough, you probably like to get more activity of people anticipating it. And I have to say, every time the IAS bring out some new pronouncement on FRS 17 or IAS 19, we do get queries from, you know, from hedge funds and people wanting to know what it means for the gilt market, to which the answer is usually not very much, but that's not usually the answer they want.
Yeah, it occurred to me that one big difference between life companies and pension funds is kind of the stakeholders involved in these. And it just reminded me of a conversation I had a few months ago with a senior person of a FTSE 100 company that, with a defined benefit pension scheme, and he said something to me that was a revelation, really, that it wasn't in a hurry to eliminate the deficit, i.e. so it wasn't in a hurry to start hedging out things or to protect the deficit from getting bigger and hope for an upside, because he saw the deficit as a cheap form of finance. Whereas an insurance company just... that wasn't the way I was trained, and clearly trustees don't see it that way, and clearly not all companies would like their deficit to get too big either. But there's just different vested interests going on, and the impact that these different changes in the different sectors is different. But it's hard to quantify.
So in terms of the effect of pension schemes on the bond market, I think it's important to remember that although pension scheme liabilities are valued off AA corporate bonds, the pension schemes are usually holding bonds which aren't exactly the right duration. And if they're worried about the stability of the pension scheme numbers in their accounts, they'd probably do something about moving some of their assets out of equities into bonds first, rather than wondering about whether they should have more in corporate bonds or gilts or swaps. I'm not sure that would... Any change in accounting measure would really change the investment strategy of pension schemes that much. The weighting to bonds has increased a bit, but it hasn't increased hugely. I think an interesting area, though, where pension schemes are looking to an extent in terms of credit derivatives is looking at a credit default swap based on the name of the sponsor to try and protect the funding of a pension scheme in the event that the sponsor goes under and there's a deficit left. I'm not sure the number of pension schemes for whom that's actually an option, given that it needs to be a fairly well-traded instrument to make it worthwhile. But I think it's also worth noting that if the pension scheme, if the sponsor does go bust, then it's probably going to be when markets aren't doing so well, so you probably won't have bought enough credit default swap to cover your deficit anyway. So I thought it was interesting that given the working party is actually set up by the Life Board, there are quite a few roles for CDS like that for pension schemes. It'd be interesting to see if the working party was going to extend its remit to look more at pension scheme aspects.
I'm not sure we're allowed to unless they are the Life Board, the pension board mandate us to, but it's interesting you mentioned credit default swaps for pension funds for credit protection, because the pension protection fund, who set the risk-based levy for pension funds and decide how risky a pension scheme is, when they set that risk-based levy, they do give some regard to what they call contingent assets. And a contingent asset is basically an asset who has a value when the sponsor's not there, because the PPF don't really care how well-funded you are today. What they care is how well-funded you're going to be if the company goes down. So in theory, if you have an asset that whose value increases at the time that the company goes bust, that should be taken into account in terms of the risk-based levy, in theory. In practice, they've decided not to recognise credit default swaps. So if a life company just does if a pension fund buys a credit default swap on its sponsor, it will not get recognition in the risk-based levy for that. And there was a very sort of complicated debate between ISDA, who were the people who, effectively the PPF said, we don't think the credit default swap market is well developed enough and there are not standardised documentation involved with it. And they effectively expressed a view they thought it was a little bit too embryonic to recognise. ISDA, who are the people who do documentation for credit derivatives, took huge offence at that, given they've been working on this documentation for the last 10 years and it's been tested through Parmalat default and all sorts of other defaults, and had a hugely robust and somewhat heated debate with the PPF on that, but actually ended up not being able to reach an agreement. So at the moment, effectively, if a pension fund wants to buy some sort of instrument that does get them credit under their PPF levy, what they have to really do is either go to a bank or an insurance company and get them to issue a different type of contract, like a letter of credit or an insurance policy, which do get recognition under the levy. The bank or the insurance company might then use a CDS to hedge their risk out, but for whatever reason, and it perhaps says something about how quickly they'll take up these instruments, pension funds and life companies, the PPF deemed that CDS were not an acceptable instrument to get reduction to your risk-based levy. And as of now, that's sort of under review, but there's no imminent sort of suggestion they're going to change that view, which I think is a shame, but maybe I'm biased because I work for a bank.
One of the key differences between pension funds and insurance companies, and while I agree with Gary's point that regulatory factors shouldn't drive investment policy, one of the big differences is that insurance companies need to worry about the 1 in 200 year event, the ICA stress, whereas pension funds maybe ought to but don't need to routinely. And also don't think that you should set your investment policy with the 1 in 200 year event in mind. You should set your investment policy and then say what if, and see if you can mitigate it in some way. And using structured credit as a hedge, something that will pay out very handsomely in a severe stress situation for credit, is an obvious thing for an insurance company to do to deal with that the ICA stress, whereas pension funds won't have the incentive to do it just now.
I agree with that, and I think it actually, what it might do is influence the type of hedging that you get. And if an insurance company was to choose a hedging strategy, it's likely to choose hedging strategies that protect it from quite extreme scenarios. So they would look at all sorts of market and credit risk, you know, the vagas and gammas as well. Whereas a pension fund, if it was to use derivatives, it would probably be to put a floor on how deep the deficit can go, but with the hope that there'll be good upside and reduce future contributions. But it would be a more economic type of hedge and not an extreme protection hedge. I absolutely agree with that.
I think the other aspect is if you are buying credit protection, then you're de-risking and therefore you're paying out the risk premium. As we said, you actually get more risk premium from bonds than the expected default. And that's going to be a huge impediment to the idea of pension funds buying out the exposure they have to their corporate sponsor, because the cost that they would have to pay would be the credit spread for that particular name, and that's going to be significantly above what they perceive to be the risk of default. And we've had some conversations with corporates about that concept, but it will, so far has founded quite quickly on that pricing problem. Generally, the names where the protection is fairly cheap are names where the trustees aren't particularly concerned that their sponsor is going to go bust and not be able to pay, and even then they're paying out higher than they expect the risk of default. The trustees that are interested in buying protection are generally the ones where the sponsoring corporate is not that creditworthy, and the cost of the protection is very, very large, so they don't want to pay that either.
I think what we might see is if deficits start to recover and people start worrying about almost unrecoverable surpluses, which would be probably fall into the category of nice problem to have for most pension funds, but it potentially could be a real problem, because we have seen, you know, you talk about the cost of doing it, but we have seen people like Marks and Spencer and Henkel in Germany and a few other public examples, Invensys in the UK, issuing bonds and using the proceeds of the bonds to fund a pension deficit. By issuing a bond, they're paying the credit spread, which is about the same as the cost, subject to the basis comment I made, it's basically the same cost as the cost they would pay to buy the CDS above risk-free. So potentially, one could be an alternative to the other. I think in reality, when people have those discussions, it usually ends up with, well, I'd rather have the cash, thank you very much. You know, most of the pension scheme sponsors say, well, I think I'd rather like to have the cash under all circumstances, not just under the circumstance of you defaulting. And maybe I can also invest it in equity markets and actually earn higher returns as well. And there are certain tax advantages to actually doing it with a physical bond. So you look at Marks and Spencer, I mean, they got a tax arbitrage, if you like, by issuing a bond and putting the money in the pension fund, which was therefore advantageous to them than, say, issuing a CDS and not putting the money in the pension fund. So I have to say, so far, discussions on CDS are probably more something that's used as sort of part of a bargaining discussion and a nice theoretical discussion. They probably haven't happened that much. I guess that's probably your experience as well.
Okay, I think Hamish Gray had a question or comment there. Scott, sorry.
Eve question, I think. I think I'm beginning to understand these, but I'm frightened at the prospect of trying to explain them to non-executive directors. And I imagine pension scheme actuaries might worry about explaining these to trustees. I wonder whether the panel have had any experience of trying to explain these to people who are not investment professionals, and whether they achieved success in putting over the ideas that these were good things to buy.
marketing opportunity.
Yeah. I suspect we've all had some experience of trying to explain complicated instruments to pension trustees or other people who are not familiar with those instruments. I think the big issue in tackling that with boards, the boards really have intellectual capacity to understand the problem. The issue I see in the insurance industry at the moment is if you don't have the models to be able to implement those within the system, then it's very hard to have that discussion. There's a lot of the question the boards are interested in, what's it going to do for me in these circumstances? So you need to be able to do scenario testing and also to be able to tell the board that once you've got the position in place, that you can continue to do that type of scenario testing so that you'll be able to monitor the effectiveness of the hedge. If you can go, however complicated the instrument happens to be, if you can go to the board and say, this is a scenario, this is what it does for me, then it's not that difficult to get across a fairly complicated message. But if you can't do that and you clearly haven't got the capability to do that on an ongoing basis, then the board is naturally going to be extraordinarily nervous about using the instruments at all.
Yeah, I think I found it easier in the case when people are using them to get protection, because then it's easy to have that discussion of, well, in these circumstances, you know, this is the benefit that you will get. I think it's where perhaps, you know, CDOs may have been missold in the past is perhaps the, you know, it's got a high yield, but in these, but you know, 99 times out of 100 it will be okay, but in this 1 in 100 you'll lose all your money. And that's a more difficult discussion to have in a way, because you're not sort of, you're almost starting from the point of view of saying that, you know, this potentially could be a bad thing. And I think, as Paul said, from us, from our point of view, and I think it's probably true of our peers, we found that having the ability to provide clients with systems they can look at the risk in a sort of in the same way they look at other risks in their portfolio is quite important. So, for example, if they buy a CDO, they can see that, well, I've now got this much risk to British Telecom or whatever it might be, some of it from the physical bond and some of it from the CDO. So they can understand that that's still within the same level of risk they want to take on British Telecom. And those sort of risk reporting systems, I think, are important. And if in some ways, if the life company or pension fund doesn't have those, then perhaps they shouldn't be using those type of instruments.
Ewan, do you want to?
Yeah, I have had to explain these things. And in the context in which I was explaining them, it wasn't good news, I'm afraid, for the sellers of these things. The buyers of these things, in larger measure, have been German insurance companies. And the context that I was having to explain what they were was in a situation we were looking at potentially buying a German insurance company that had substantial exposure to CDO. And they called it a bond portfolio, but in actual fact, it was an equity portfolio. It was a private equity portfolio consisting largely of the equity tranches of CDO structure. And many of them had exposure to defaulted names, and they were still valued at book value. So there was an explanation job saying this portfolio looks like it's worth 100 million, actually it's worth 75 million. So that was a context I had to explain them in. I think there's a number of different instruments that have been described today, and I should say that I think the paper that we have from the working party does help explain in reasonably clear language the difference between the different types of derivatives, and I can see it as being a helpful document for me to try and bring non-experts on board. Credit default swaps we do use already. They're relatively straightforward because it's an insurance concept on a single name. The structured credit products do require a lot of explanation, and there needs to be clear benefit, and there needs to be modelling. So in actual fact, I think before these things can be advocated, there has to be agreement between the investment professionals, the actuarial team that are going to have to be putting it to whatever use it is, whether it's hedging, ICA risk and so on. And I think that has been the stumbling block for insurance companies, that there have generally been bigger fish to fry, and so it hasn't got the resource.
My answer to Hamish is I don't think we would have a business if we didn't have the experience and the capability to demonstrate the effectiveness of a hedge in clear, concise, and financial statements that the the decision makers are familiar with seeing. And we certainly wouldn't have a business if we didn't have the systems in place to put in the controls that are needed to convince those that are responsible for the business that the thing isn't going to go belly up. The ability to value the assets, and including the derivative assets and the liabilities, the things that they are matching on a frequent basis, and to be able to, when the change in the value of assets and liabilities changes from one period to the next, to be able to explain how much of that change is due to financial conditions, and explaining those changes on a frequent basis, being effectively doing an analysis of surplus type exercise, helps those that are responsible to gain some comfort that the whole process is under control.
Okay, thank you. Another question or comment here. Thanks.
Keith Jennings, Scottish Friendly. I've heard of credit derivatives and credit corporate bonds in general being described as being in a continuum between equity and government bonds. For an insurer who wants to diversify away some of their equity exposure, how useful is credit exposure and credit derivatives in doing that? Or is the correlation between the credit shocks and equities just too high?
I think if you look at you could say any company is a little bit, has this sort of structure. So in that sense, you know, there is clearly a correlation between holding equity in a particular company and holding the bonds of that company, although it's a relatively sort of weak correlation in one sense, because the equity market tends to do what the equity market does, and you know, the bond market behaves, you know, it's all about whether it defaults or not. So the equity market is all about the value when you happen to sell your equity, and the bond is whether the company went bust or not. So if you're an investor in a company that doesn't go bust, you'll ultimately get your money back. Whereas what you'll get on the equity may be very dependent on the market conditions when you come in and out. But you know, the derivative market is starting to almost bridge that gap between the equity market and the credit market. So in a way, the market developments are actually to try and almost bring those two together and arbitrage the differences between them and make them more consistent in a way. I think one definitely has to be wary. I did some work with a life company recently where maybe I wasn't talking my book very well, but certainly they were looking at sort of CDO type investments in a portfolio that was very heavily equity biased. And yes, in the sort of 1 in 200 year type of events that Ewan mentioned that they have to reserve against, their equity was doing badly and these mezzanine CDOs they would have bought were doing badly. So in that sense, it wasn't a diversifying asset at all. So I think it is important to understand the links. And again, a good risk system in theory should link those two and the different exposures between them. And certainly a lot of the sort of economic scenario generators that life company users use when they set their ICAs actually do have underlying drivers that sort of link the credit process and the equity process that enable you to see that. But I guess historically equity markets and credit markets have been quite different worlds. A lot of banks have very separate equity divisions and fixed income divisions historically, maybe changing. And I think investment managers have probably been the same. Interesting, I guess, in Ewan's view on that one.
Yeah, happy to provide. You ask an excellent question, because I think you do need to be aware of the diversification benefits you're getting across your entire portfolio, because within these structures, clearly diversification is good for the structure. But is it good for you as an investor? That's a different question. So recently, because credit has been the penalty for borrowing, if you like, the credit spread's been so narrow that many companies in sectors that wouldn't ordinarily be borrowing are entering the debt market now, and so you get diversification. But these are industries that are far more cyclical than we would naturally want to lend by their corporate bonds. So diversification isn't always wonderful. What I think these structures do though is provide access to markets that aren't normally available to institutional investors. So mention was made to how Northern Rock have tranched up their mortgage book. And now, as institutional investors, we can come in and we can buy access to mortgage-backed securities through CDO structures or through just simple mortgage-backed bonds. The advantage of that is, if you think about the last recent big nasty event, the sort of 2000-2003 equity market correction, there was lots of nasty credit events associated with that. And that's because that was a corporate recession, it was an earnings recession. Companies had a really bad time. Individuals didn't particularly. There wasn't a consumer recession during that period, and so generally people's mortgages got paid. So if you can diversify between the corporate and the household sector, that's helpful.
I think there's been quite a lot of work done in most investment banks and a number of hedge funds as well about the correlation in extreme events. And that may be something that the insurance industry starts to progress on as they become more sophisticated in modelling of very extreme events, because one of the not quite an arbitrage, but ways that banks and hedge funds have looked to make money is to look at the pricing of credit default swaps against the pricing of way out the money equity puts, because you certainly know that when a name's defaulted on its debt, that its equity has gone to zero. So the question is, should you actually protect yourself against extreme events by buying lots of out-of-the-money equity puts, or maybe should you protect yourself against that event by buying a default protection against a basket of names? And as the correlation modelling is going to become a lot more sophisticated in the insurance industry, and I think they will come into a position where they can actually participate in that type of discussion and actually make a decision at the investment side and the board side as to whether they do want to protect their business as a whole against the extreme events when correlations typically converge towards one. And then where is the best place to start protecting it? Should they be de-risking the credit side? Should they be de-risking the equity side? Should they do that with physical transactions or by buying derivatives of one form or another?
100% agree with that. There's clearly a very strong correlation between the falling share price and widening, increasing credit spread. But there's a very different payoff in extreme events. And I just got a personal experience. I was unlucky enough to have shares in Marconi, but I was very envious of the debt holders, because they got paid out a lot more than the shareholders did. The problem is that when the company's defaulted, the shareholders get literally next to nothing. The debt holders didn't get a fantastic deal, but it was restructured so that they could get something. Another very, very interesting aside to that as well is that currently trading costs on credit spread options are higher, or the liquidity's lower than on equity puts. And one way of getting just a very loose hedge on against the credit spread widening is just to protect yourself against the equity price falling. So strong is that basic correlation. Of course, being able to demonstrate, you would have a basis risk there, but it is a technique which is used.
Paul?
Just quickly, I think something else this comes back to is, if you've got something like a CDO, knowing what names are in there, because if it turns out the names in there are fairly similar to the equities that you're holding, then you're going to have a greater concentration of risk. And Ewan's point is a good point, that one of the advantages of products like this is that it might give you access to lenders or institutions or products which are very different to the equities that you might hold and you might not otherwise have access to, and that's part of the advantage of them. But I think what it all comes back to is know what's in there, know what you're actually getting exposure to.
David Martin.
David Martin, there was concern expressed or disappointment expressed about the attitude of the PPF to this sort of market, and I was just been thinking that what the PPF are concerned about are what are described here as credit events. And I just wondered if there were any comments that the panel had in connection with perhaps two areas. One is the actual setting of the levy, where the Dun & Bradstreet ratings are somewhat controversially used, and whether the PPF could learn anything from the expertise that people involved in these devices would have. And secondly, whether the investment of the PPF funds themselves might benefit by investment in this sort of instrument?
I've got a couple of quick comments. I mean, I think ultimately on Dun & Bradstreet, the reason it had to be used is because while we all get very excited about the FTSE 100 and et cetera, and the people that actually have S&P ratings and have credit derivatives on them, there's an awful lot of schemes that don't. You arguably get a lot better price on some of the bigger corporates for their real risk from the markets, but whatever reason the PPF have chosen to be sort of consistent and stick with Dun & Bradstreet, that potentially does open some opportunities where there might be companies where the Dun & Bradstreet rating is sort of more penal than the market would charge, and again issuing bonds or buying credit protection for those companies might be a way of arbitraging the PPF, which would probably be unfortunate for the PPF, but we could see that, particularly now the levy's quadrupled effectively, because the levy in the first year was very cheap. They scaled it down by the 0.53 factor. That's effectively quadrupled now as a factor, so I think we're starting to see a bit of interest in that. In terms of the investment policy of the PPF, I think they would like to, but are not convinced about it. I mean, probably shouldn't quote someone, I guess, in a meeting like this on the record, should I? But I've certainly had conversations with people at the PPF suggesting that, you know, in theory at least, yes, they probably should buy large amounts of credit protection on British Telecom, because if British Telecom were to go bust, that would be an enormous hole in the PPF, given their underfunded pension scheme. The reality of their ability to really do that without creating sort of negative headlines, and is that what people are expecting, I think is a debatable point. I think what you might see in a few years' time is perhaps them looking more at tranching up that risk and passing it out to the markets. And I have even heard suggestions that sort of certain financial investors have made approaches to the PPF in that regard, that, you know, we can actually take that risk off your hands and put it into the capital markets. I think that's probably sort of not as high up the PPF's agenda as just getting up and running and getting the levy in and starting to pay out some claims to people. But I think that's something they may well think about going forward.
I think they are quite sophisticated, actually, the people at the PPF, and they do recognise that this is an area where they can learn from the markets. And I'm not convinced that the stance they've taken is actually particularly a negative one for their view of credit default swaps and related technology. From their perspective, there's a lot of reason why they might be interested in using that technology, because as a portfolio protection, a lot of the products are clearly likely to work very well. I'm guessing, but I suspect one of their issues to recognition of these instruments for individual schemes is that when you distill down to one entity, you always have a lot of specific risk, not just about the entity itself, but also about the definition of the debt and defaults and whether it's actually happened and who's going to get paid. And we have seen in physical debt markets in the past that once you get into a default situation, the covenants can be very important to determining whether you get paid or not. So it's not just the credit derivative definition as to whether you've got the right definition of default in your derivative and the right definition to make sure that you get paid out. It's something that impacts on physical bonds as well, where we've seen some issues where one type of bondholder's got paid virtually in full and another's got lost all their money because of different covenants. And I suspect that the PPF may be nervous about that type of effect when looking at single company credit default technology. So if you're protecting against your own scheme, clearly if you're looking at protecting the entire portfolio or the entire UK universe as they are, then generally there would be swings and roundabouts effects within that, so they could make more use of the technology themselves.
You're having sort of rude things about the PPF, maybe I probably should explain where they did get to on some of those issues. I mean, there were various issues they had. One was, does default or a credit event for a CDS, is that the same thing as a pension fund going bust? I think they managed to get reasonably comfortable with that. They're not 100% comfortable. A second one was this whole sort of issue of recovery rate, because a CDS, if you've got a deficit of 100, you take out a CDS of 100, you don't actually get paid 100. Well, you do get paid 100 when the company goes bust, but you're expected to deliver back 100's worth of bonds. And that was a bit of an issue for them. How does the pension fund actually buy this 100's worth of bonds? You know, what does that mean? Because effectively, In reality, if British Telecom, to take an example and not picking on them, were to go insolvent, the pension fund would expect to recover some money from British Telecom. It wouldn't lose all, it would get some of its deficit covered as any other bondholder. And the CDS is only supposed to really bridge the gap. But the PPF struggled a little bit with that, this issue of sort of almost having to get two lots of recoveries. They rather preferred some sort of situation, which is true in the insurance markets, where effectively the insurance company would recover it. So, you know, if the insurance company writes off your car, they effectively take possession of your car, and it's their problem to sort of actually, if they can get some recovery value for that car. The analogy with sort of credit default options is that, you know, in a credit default option, it would be a little bit like if you crashed your car, the company, and you had to actually take your car and work out how much you could flog your written-off car for, and the insurance company only bridged the gap, and that they struggled with a little bit. And then there's a very technical point about actually what they want is perpetual protection, because they're concerned about someone buying 5 years' worth of credit protection, which is a typical term of CDS, and not renewing it in 5 years' time. And maybe the company hasn't gone bust in 5 years' time, but it's been downgraded and it's now trading near junk levels and it's very difficult to buy the protection. So they wanted to come up with something where the very act of not renewing the credit default swap would itself constitute an event of default. And ultimately what they were doing in a way was they were creating a new contract that wasn't a credit default swap. And arguably the whole point of the credit default swap market is it's a liquid market, it's heavily traded, it's very tight bid offers. That was the very attraction to companies of using credit default swaps. Effectively what the PPF ended up with was a version of credit default swaps that would have been uniquely traded by pension funds, in which case you may as well not use a credit default swap. You may as well, as I said, go to a bank or an insurance company, get something more tailored, and let them hedge it out the other side. So there was I think their issues were legitimate ones. I think it's more, I don't mean it's any form of criticism. I think it's just a shame from all parties concerned that we couldn't actually reach an agreement on that.
Yeah. The recovery rate point's a good one, because the pension scheme liabilities have a different priority according to how severe the deficit is. So it may be that some part of the deficit gets paid immediately in preference to bondholders, and then bondholders would step in and get paid in preference to the rest of the pension fund. So it's not clear that the recovery amount that you would get under a credit default swap, which would typically be linked through to bond recoveries, is actually in any way commensurate to the recovery amount that is required for the pension fund. Generally, if everything goes belly up and you get nothing from anything, then it works. But in the interim scenarios where you've got partial recoveries, you may find that the hedge effectiveness is very difficult to ascertain.
It's also worth remembering that however much the PPF might want to take some of the lessons from this sort of work on board, it's dealing with a very large number of pension schemes with comparatively limited resources, so it has to make some fairly broad generalisations just to actually get the work done. In terms of the investment strategy of the PPF itself, I suppose although it might want to have some credit insurance, it would be paying away the premium, and it does have the advantage that other insurance companies don't have, in that people have to buy insurance off it, so it can just change the rates in subsequent years if it turns out that there's not as much money as it thought it had.
The PPF is actually one institution that probably almost should leap straight past credit default swaps into CDO-type technology, because their risk really is a large number of defaults causing deficits to make a call upon their resources, and clearly the difficulty for them in raising their levy above certain percentages and certain calls on the store solvent fund. So it's that type of hedge that's probably more useful to them than worrying about any individual default, although I guess they may decide that some schemes have such big deficits they do need specific protection on the sponsoring corporate.
Okay.
The name is Robert Clarkson. Like Hamish Scott, I'd like to ask a naive question, and one which I admit is out with the terms of reference of the working party, we're looking to consider examples for life insurance companies using derivatives. Looking at sections 30 and 31 of Part B, the review of the literature, you refer to the Elton Gruber et al. Study, which says that the excess returns in credit derivatives can be explained in three ways: the expected default losses, beta premium for the risk, and also differential taxation. Section 31 then says, effectively discount the expected default losses. The return is far greater than that. I'm not familiar with the Fama and French 93 paper about credit risk, but the more important 92 paper in the equity market essentially showed that the capital asset pricing model based on beta simply didn't work over the current century, even taking into account the depression years. My suspicion is that if Warren Buffett read this paper, he would suspect that on most occasions there was a satisfactory excess return over, let us say, a 1929 type scenario. Would the Working Party suggest that any classes of investor might possibly look at credit derivatives as an alternative asset for a small proportion of their assets that might give a better return than quoted equities or private equity?
That's a very detailed question. I think, first of all, I would say that Elton and Gruber is one of the few things we sort of quote here, and they did sort of somehow manage, it seemed, to explain the credit spread pretty well using the Fama French model. It might be a typo there in terms of 93, 92, because I think it is referring to the basic model. So apologies if that's a year out of date. Probably is when they published the paper in one journal rather than another, I suspect. So I think if you take the Elton, Gruber and Agrawal and Mann analysis at face value, effectively it's saying that credit is as good as an investment as equity, i.e. in the same way they could explain the equity risk premium, they were getting very similar results to credit. So in that sense, I guess they were saying that credit is not any particularly worse, but equally well, not any particularly better than equities, and you take your pick in terms of the sort of payoff that you're looking for and diversification and all those other good things. I think some of the other papers were almost suggesting that there might be, and perhaps life companies historically have perhaps at least believed implicitly in the way they've run their annuity books, that there might be something specially associated with credit risk. And I think that's where probably we as a working party had probably more misgivings, I think it's fair to say, looking for other working party members for confirmation.
I think the skew is an important factor here. There's clearly some spread to be had within credit. If you say maybe you've got an expectation of 4% risk premium from equities, and then you look at a corporate bond portfolio that's yielding 40 basis points of spread above its expected defaults, then you've got to buy 10 times as much of the bond portfolio to extract the same amount of risk premium. Now, your expected losses on those two outcomes may look similar, risk profile. Actually, in a very poor market scenario, you're going to lose a lot more money on the bond portfolio. So your extreme event activity is going to look a lot worse by trying to extract risk premium from bonds. And I think that's something that insurance companies can see now, and it does actually lead you to the idea that CDO technology is worth considering, because when you look at the equity tranche or the mezzanine tranches of CDOs, you're actually getting closer to an equity type of risk premium. You may find that an equity tranche of CDO is giving you a risk premium of 4, 5, 6%, so you have to buy the same amount of that tranche as you would invest in equities to get a certain yield pickup. And clearly, in the worst case scenario, the answer is the same. You lose all your money, one unit per one unit. So you've actually, for a given amount of risk premium that you're trying to extract from your portfolio, you end up taking less extreme event risk
by going through risky tranches of CDOs. And clearly you can get to the same answer by saying that you should take, when you do take credit risk, you should actually take a lot more in notional size and then buy back cover against those extreme events because they're the ones you're concerned about. Say the 1 in 200 year event analysis insurance companies have got to do pushes them that way as well.
I think just for the record, I think it depends on the type of credit derivative. If one's wanting to use credit derivatives to enhance return, effectively, I don't want to call it for speculative purposes, but not necessarily for what we call reduction of risk or efficient portfolio management in the old PGN 95.3. It depends on the type of derivative. A derivative that's going to pay off in a 1 in 200 event and gives you naught in all other cases because it was designed purely for protection purposes, I think that's not a good investment to enhance returns because you don't want something that gives you a return in 1 in 200 scenarios. It's intended to be used for protection against the 1 in 200 scenario. I think it's, you know, if you combine credit derivatives with a portfolio of bonds, and et cetera, so you get an enhanced return, but you put a floor on the downside, then that is interesting.
Are there a few?
Yeah, well, certainly I think that I'm not an expert on the academic literature, but in terms of should credit risk be ranked alongside other opportunities like exposure to equity and exposure to private equity, yes, I think in a balanced portfolio that would be perfectly appropriate. And the fact that you can use these instruments to raise the level of return for a small investment to credit, it makes it interesting. I think the timing is a different issue, and I would actually, I think the extent to which credit is being extended, as I've already said, to industries that are very cyclical, the very in private equity, the very attractive credit extension and the leveraged loan market to private equity enterprise, does mean that aspects of the credit market might not be rewarding going forward. But as a basic strategy, having these things of almost equal weight in portfolios seems like a sensible approach.
Paul?
I'm not sure, but I suspect that a lot of the time when people talk about the beta return for corporate bonds, they're using beta as a shorthand for you've got some volatility relative to something which is risk-free and you'll get some level of reward for that volatility rather than a direct CAPM type relationship where your higher beta implies a higher return. I suspect it's just talking in general terms about there's additional risk and you get additional return for that risk. I suppose it's worth remembering that if you've got a particular company and you own all the debt and you own all the equity, well, you basically own the whole company and you'll get the returns from that company. Whether you hold the equity or the debt just determines the pattern of those returns, in that if things go very well, equity holders benefit disproportionately. If things go very badly, debt holders lose disproportionately. And I think it's, in terms of how it can fit into your portfolio, that it's the way in which you package up those types of risk together to make sure you're not just, you haven't just got two portfolios which contain all the same names, so you're basically subjecting yourself to the same sorts of risks. So I think it's how you group these different types of instruments together is as big an issue as what sort of risks you are ultimately leaving yourself open to.
Okay, I think we're going to have to close the discussion there because time is running away from us. But I think the fact that I have to do that is a tribute to the contribution that our five panelists have made. It has been a very interesting and wide-ranging discussion, and I would like you to join with me in congratulating all five panelists in the normal way. Thank you very much indeed. The fourth sessional meeting will be held on Monday the 19th of February at the Merchants Hall in Edinburgh. The topic will be pension scheme funding and sponsor covenants, and this will be a structured discussion led by a panel of industry experts. Thank you. And with that, I now declare the meeting closed.